I do not practice these moves at home.
Oh!
That's not what I hear.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Grab your plunder and open the pay window. It's time for Survey Says.
Get on the edge of your seat.
One more for the good guy.
Holy smokes.
Space Mountain is open for business, getting all up in your area once again. Welcome to the inaugural edition of Survey Says, a WCW retrospective. Hopefully it won't be our only edition. But if you are hearing this episode, that means we're off to a great start. We are coming to you live, as previously recorded, virtually, that is, from the Greensboro Coliseum, 16,000 strong, packed to the rafters on what promises to be the greatest night in the history of our sport, or possibly the worst. We make no claims to preference or propriety here on Survey Says. What exactly do I mean, and what exactly is Survey Says? More on that in just a moment. Hi, everybody. My name is Tim Psychosis Capel, and you may know me from Place to Be Nation's Comics Contingent. What you may not know, that is because I've never talked about it on one of our great companion podcasts, is that I have a deep and abiding passion for the world of professional wrestling as well. All of that changes tonight. Joining me for each and every episode is my co-captain. He is a voice you've heard across a variety of Place to Be Nation podcasts. He writes about the X-Files and terrible movies starring wrestlers for PlaceToBeNation.com. I present to you the Beast from the east of Peoria, Mr. Andy Savage Helene.
Woo! It's great to be in Flair Country.
Andy, how are you? Are you jacked up and ready to go?
Yes, I'm pumped.
And did I get all of your names right?
Yes, you did. It was great. A great intro.
Thank you. Excellent. Good God. All right. We are off and running. Let's get into what exactly this show is, right? Survey Says, a WCW retrospective, or we'll just call it Survey Says going forward. This is going to be a loving look back at the world of WCW, World Championship Wrestling, warts and all. I don't think we're going to be offering any real defenses against the things they did wrong, but we are going to celebrate the bad along with the good, right? Or stated another way, you and I, Andy, we unapologetically love us some shitty WCW.
Yes, I do.
Excellent. So, I mean, at the end of the day, we are talking about a company that's been dead for 15 plus years now. You can play the could've, would've, should've game. None of that matters anymore in retrospect. My attitude is that while WCW was frequently bad, it was usually at least entertainingly or interestingly bad. And with the benefit of 2020 hindsight, I think that I more than often find humor rather than despair in that company's blunders. Would that be a fair assessment on your part?
Yeah, I was going to say that it has its charm.
It has its charms, for sure. And, you know, I feel like we should note as well that we are not wrestling historians. you know, our knowledge and personal interests only go back so far. So if you want to hear things like Lou Thesz beating Abraham Lincoln for the NWA championship in 1847 or whatever the hell, you're just going to need to look elsewhere. Our wheelhouse is not exclusively, but primarily going to be 90s WCW. And that includes the Hogan era. So this definitely isn't going to be to all taste. We get that. But it should give you an idea of what you're in for. All that said, I think this is going to be an educational journey for both of us as we kind of delve deeper into the product and WCW's history. We hope and expect we will find some appeal and kind of the classic stuff, things that were there all along, but maybe has gone overlooked by our generation, which I think we're kind of the same generation of wrestling fandom. So all that is to say, you know, if you are like an old school NWA fan, maybe we'll meet in the middle if you stick around with us long enough. But that may not be the demographic that we're targeting from the outset, to say the least. Does that make sense?
Yeah, because the 80s isn't as much in my wheelhouse, but I do like the Midnight Express, and I like Tully and Arn Anderson. But I guess who doesn't like those two guys? But there's still some stuff in the 80s that I like, and I guess over the years, I feel like my tastes in wrestling have almost drastically like changed. And so like maybe with, I guess, eyes of an adult, I might like the 80s stuff now, whereas it didn't interest me when I was a kid.
Yeah, you know, that's a good point. I think seeing a lot of these things through older, more mature eyes, so to speak, you sort of learn to appreciate, oh, this is all the stuff that actually influenced the things that I'm really into. This is what laid the groundwork for my era of wrestling, so to speak. So we are definitely open to and keeping an open mind when it comes to some of the more old school style wrestling, the old school type of shows. It's just we haven't really seen them. So we're going to have to be experiencing those firsthand and giving you our first impressions rather than just, you know, celebrating it from the outset. That's going to be, you know, a new foray for both of us, I think. And we're looking forward to it. But, you know, bear with us, I guess, is the best advice I could give. If you're an old school, not so much WCW, but NWA type of fan, because that's not really our formative development as wrestling fans. So, you know, along those same lines, I guess I should stress that we're not going to be reviewing WCW events chronologically here on this show. Chad and Parv, they're covering that marvelously on Where the Big Boys Play, which is a show you can find via the PWO PTBN podcast network feed. You know, in addition to that, check out the PTBN Excellent WWE Network Adventure. That's a series with Chad, JT, Scott Criscolo, Jason Greenhouse, and Dan McGinn. It's a great long-form written series that reviews every single program available on the WWE Network in order, starting from about 1975. So you can find that at placetobenation.com. Again, not what we're doing, but if that is your bag, be sure to check it out. We're not going to do single show reviews or live rewatches. That's here again to avoid format and topic overlap with some other podcasts, the network watch parties, or Ben Morris's pay-per-view rewind series, and of course the OG inimitable WWE Vintage Vaults with JT and Scott. They've pretty much got that beat covered. I feel like we're going to make some lists along the way here, you know, not really in the form of structured countdown, so to speak, but maybe we could do like a crossover with Jordan Duncan's rank and file here again from the PTBN pop feed. Andy, how do you think I've done here so far on the soft plugs for other podcasts on the Place to Be Nation network?
You've done marvelously. Mick Foley would be proud of all your big pops.
I'm so glad. So in addition to the Place to Be Nation, check out PWO, PTBN, and PTBN Pop Feeds, all great podcasts that you can find on iTunes.
Yeah, I just want to say that I don't know if we'll have much of a actual like structure with reviewing each and specifically show like you had said. I just want to get together and laugh, and I think that this show is going to be up your alley if you just love Dusty Rhodes talking about plunder.
Exactly. Exactly. That's my thinking as well. So, I mean, broadly speaking, what you are going to hear on the show, in addition to Dusty Rhodes plunder, some shenanigans, some hijinks, our format, such as it will, to the extent that we're going to have one. Again, if we have future episodes, which we're hoping you will, and fans, please help us out in that regard by telling our overlords at Place to Be Nation that you want additional episodes. But what we're trying to do here is cover the world of WCW and a 360-degree analysis, if you will. And that means taking a subject like a particular wrestler, a television show, an entire pay-per-view series, or just a quintessential WCW concept, and we're going to delve into the crunchy, the sometimes salty granularities of the promotion.
Slim Jim? Oh, I thought you were talking about Slim Jim.
Snap into it, right?
Yeah.
It all comes back to center, you see. So, in that spirit, I imagine this pilot is intended to serve as a taste of what you might expect in future shows. Again, should there be future shows? Finally, I should stress that we are going to have some special guests along the way, right? Whether they know about this or not, we'll probably just schedule these guys and then forget to tell them that they're booked. That would be really WCW of us, right, Andy, to just put a guest on and have them not show up or inform them maybe the day of show that they're going to be on recording with us.
Or pay them millions and millions of dollars and then have it bomb.
And then have it absolutely bomb, exactly. That would be a very WCW, quintessentially WCW thing to do. Apropos of nothing, as Steve Mongo McMichael might say, and that's just not talking about digging in the dirt with farm implements, baby. Now, with the formalities out of the way here, I imagine we should start off here by sharing our personal WCW origin stories. Let me turn it over to you, Andy. What was it that brought you to WCW? Were you already watching wrestling, or did you start out watching wrestling with WCW? What's your own relationship with World Championship Wrestling?
Well, what brought me to wrestling was actually WWF. I grew up as a WWF kid, and I was always like, that was my number one. When I saw WCW and came across it, it seemed kind of like, it seemed kind of second rate. And then the period that I saw was...
I don't mean to laugh, but go ahead.
Well, the period that I saw was where a lot of Hulk Hogan's buddies were coming in, and I actually didn't like some of those guys, like Hacksaw Jim Duggan and the Honky Tonk Man.
Mm.
So I just stuck with what I liked. I liked Bret the Hitman Hart. I liked Razor Ramon. I liked The Undertaker. And I'm like, I don't want to watch some of these guys. So I guess I kind of took the wrong mentality. Like, I should have been like, hey, it's more wrestling, you know? Like, I don't think I did that with superheroes. I like Marvel more, but I still like DC. I like Batman. And then, so it took, like I said, 94. It took me until 96 to really kind of follow it. And that was when Hall and Nash, and I think everybody else pretty much, maybe jumped aboard then, because Hall and Nash had crossed over. They were huge WWF, like, main event guys. And they were known as Diesel and Razor Ramon. And then all of a sudden, they're here under their own names, Scott Hall and Kevin Nash. And it was huge. All the eyes were on WCW there.
So is that when you felt like WCW had kind of arrived? Did you feel like those guys legitimized WCW for you in a way that they weren't quite so second rate anymore? Or was it just... More of a curiosity where you're like, maybe I'll pay more attention to WCW than I had in the past, but they're still taking a back seat to the WWF. What was the case there for you?
I think it could have been that, because one of my friends in grade school, his name was Chad, he's the one that kind of got me into wrestling, because he was always talking about it in school, and we'd trade off and get pay-per-views and stuff. Well, I never watched WCW too often, but I think he loved Hulk Hogan, so that's why he started watching it when Hulk Hogan showed up. And so I'd hear different things from him in school, and he told me one day, hey, like, did you see that Hall and Nash are in WCW? So then that's when I was like, oh, wow, cool, I'll check it out.
Okay. So it was already on your radar, but then it was like all of a sudden, oh, wait a minute, this might be a bigger deal than I've considered it before in the past.
Yeah, because as I said, Razor Ramon was one of my favorite in the World Wrestling Federation.
He was one of your guys.
Yeah, exactly.
My experience is somewhat similar to your own. I first started watching wrestling with the WWF in, I guess it was the early 90s. It's hard to pin down an exact year because – I was always really into Jake the Snake. I was one of those weird kids who I had a lot of interests, and I was into reptiles. So I thought snakes were cool. I started watching wrestling. Here's a guy who comes out to the ring with a snake. So, okay, that's my shit. So immediately I was drawn to Jake the Snake Roberts. And no matter what he did, you know, in the WWF, he was a face. When I started watching it, he turned heel. I didn't care. Like, I thought that when he turned heel, he was just cooler. Like, I didn't think he had betrayed his fans or turned his back on anybody, or like I should stop rooting for him. I just thought he was cooler after he turned heel. And, you know, you had the great segment with the Cobra biting Savage. And I mean, I just lost my mind, because now he had really just leaned into this diabolical character that was always there around the fringes, around the edges that he had hinted at, but had never quite fully embraced. And now, like, he's just the Snake Man, crazy, you know, off his rocker heel. And I was all in. So the feud with Savage in particular is what hooked me into wrestling. I didn't care what Hulk Hogan was doing. I didn't care what Ric Flair was up to. I didn't care that he had defected from WCW, came to the WWF. I was vaguely aware of these things, but didn't really matter to me. I just cared about Jake the Snake Roberts feuding with Randy Savage and burying the Ultimate Warrior in a graveyard, as absurd as it was, like, I was into it. And then all of a sudden, Jake Roberts was gone. This happened, you know, around the midpoint of 1992. And pretty much as soon as he left, my interest in professional wrestling just really waned. I mean, there were other guys that I kind of liked, but they weren't enough to really keep me in it.
Well, you might really love Halloween Havoc 92 then.
Well, that may be a discussion for another day, my friend, because I have some very mixed feelings about that show. You know, I was always kind of aware of WCW as a thing. Like you said, they were the second-rate wrestling promotion, right? You know, my dad, I think, was an old-school NWA guy where, you know, he was into Ric Flair and Tully Blanchard and Magnum TA and those guys. And he wasn't quite as into the WWF until I got into the WWF. And he would just sort of tell me things like, hey, you know, Ric Flair came over from WCW. That's why he's such a big deal. And Lex Luger, he came over from WCW. And I'd just be like, yeah, okay, whatever. And what happened was Jake Roberts, of course, went to the WCW in mid to late 1992. And I was like, oh, maybe I should start paying attention to WCW. Jake, of course, did not last long in World Championship Wrestling, did not do much of note in the promotion. So my interest here again waned. And for all intents and purposes, I was out of professional wrestling from about, gosh, I would say 1994 until the better part of 1997. And what actually got me hooked again, now, having said this, I did go to a live event, a WWF pay-per-view in 1997. It was A Cold Day in Hell in Your House, May of 1997, an early Steve Austin Undertaker main event, pretty good match. But I was not actively watching the promotion at the time. It was just one of those shows that came to the Richmond Coliseum. I live in Richmond, so went to the show, but didn't know a whole lot going in, didn't know a lot about the storylines, the promotion, the top guys, but had a good time at the show. Put wrestling back on my radar. But what got me back into wrestling proper was Starrcade 1997. Main event, Sting versus Hollywood Hogan. It was the match that was, what, 16 months in the making, so to speak. One of those deals where my dad's neighbor ordered the pay-per-view over the holidays, invited us over, said, hey, want to come next door, watch the pay-per-view? We're going to order pizza, hang out, just have a good time. And I mean, I'd heard about the hype going into it. I knew about Sting versus Hogan being a big deal, Bret Hart defecting to WCW being a big deal, but here again, hadn't been watching the product week to week. But with them having ordered the pay-per-view, inviting us over, it was like, hell yeah, let's check this out. And sure enough, we went over there, watched the pay-per-view, and Starrcade 97 was, it's one of those deals that you look back on in hindsight and think was a disappointment, but me being a 14-year-old kind of non-wrestling or casual wrestling fan at the time, when you don't know what to expect going in, you can't really call a show a disappointment. Does that make sense?
Yeah, because you're kind of like you have an open mind, right? So you're not going in thinking it's going to be like something that it's not.
I mean, I didn't know what was going to be on that show other than Sting versus Hogan, in all honesty. And I figured that they're going to have a match. Sting is going to beat Hogan and leave with the WCW championship, which, I mean, in all honesty, it is what happened. There were, oh boy, some shady dealings throughout the course of that match and the show as a whole. I mean, it basically delivered on my non-expectations, such as they were. I didn't know what I wanted out of the show going in, but I just knew it was a wrestling pay-per-view. It was my first wrestling pay-per-view. I had never ordered any pay-per-view prior to that. It was one of those things where my parents kind of didn't believe in paying for, you know, sporting events or wrestling pay-per-views, which were upwards of, you know, $30 at the time. We didn't even have a cable box until I feel like 1995, 1996-ish. So, I mean, that wasn't really even an option for me. You know, that brings me to my second question for you, Andy. What was your first wrestling pay-per-view purchase, whether WWF or WCW? Again, emphasis on WCW. What was your first pay-per-view?
Well, my first pay-per-view that I watched on cable, it was actually it kind of had like a scenario of like a weird screwy ending, like your Starcade, because my first one was Royal Rumble 94 for the WWF.
And, oh, wow.
And so you had the Undertaker who had apparently died because he was like attacked by a gang of guys, a gang of Yokozuna thugs. And then you had the main event, the Royal Rumble, where it was 30 guys in one match. And that kind of had controversy. It had Bret Hart and it had Lex Luger. Like they both fell out onto the floor at the same time. So you didn't know who had won because one referee said one guy won. The other referee said the other guy won. And they didn't really do a whole lot of instant replay stuff back then. So it was like
that's a great point. Not to interrupt you, but something I have observed in watching old wrestling shows, instant replays, it didn't really become a thing, I feel like, until about 97, 98. And having said that, it was the WWF who was showing you, they would put up the double screen, right? The double feature
yeah, the
of
picture in picture.
Yeah, yeah. So there's this great move that just happened. We're going to show you again while the match is still going on. And they do the replay in the middle of the match. That wasn't really a thing until the WWF started doing it until 97, 98. WCW never really did that. I mean, they would show you at the end of the match replays of the action as they kind of recapped and gave you the summary, the summation of what happened in the match itself. But if you missed something, you were pretty much on your own or had to, you know, nowadays you have to, you know, just back it up on the WWE Network if that's what you're watching it on. But it just goes to show the difference between the production quality of WWF versus WCW. I'm not saying WCW wouldn't have gotten there eventually of showing replays via progress within the match itself, but that was something they never really did. It's something that as a, you know, looking through our modern lens of, you know, if you missed a move, no big deal, you're going to see it on an instant replay 5 seconds later. That's very much the model today in 2016. But, you know, you go back to some of this stuff from the heyday of these promotions, WCW or WWF, you couldn't take that for granted. It's an adjustment that I've definitely had to make for sure. And sorry to interrupt you, but I think that's a really great point that it just goes to show how much things have changed just in terms of the production and the presentation of the product.
It's okay to interrupt. That's kind of my gimmick anyways on all these podcasts is I kind of interrupt everybody and throw out some kind of random thing. Well, yours wasn't random, yeah. But I mean, it was on topic, but
it was a rabbit trail. Yeah. We'll put it that way.
I guess you did ask me about WCW, though. What was my first event with them that I ordered? And it was actually a couple of years later. It was in 1997, and it was the Spring Stampede show. And since I was a WWF kid, usually, like, I think pay-per-views are like $30 then, and they were like $20 for the In Your House when they introduced that.
Yep.
And since I like WWF, my dad, he usually, I think he kind of split them with me. And so since I was like, you know, 13 or something, I didn't have a lot of money. I was like 12, 11, whatever. I didn't have a lot of money.
Of course. Yeah. We should stress that we're about the same age, right? So we're both like, you know, we're in our early 30s right now. So we would have been, 13, 14 back in 1997, 1998 at the height of the Monday Night Wars, which is what we're largely talking about right now.
I guess what he had said when I wanted to get a WCW one was he was like, I don't know what WCW is. You have to pay for that with your own money. I only ordered two WCW ones, not because of the money thing, but it was because, mostly I was WWF. But I did get two WCW pay-per-views, and I saw a third one at a buddy's house. And they were all around the same era. But the Spring Stampede, I remember that being really cool because I was really hyped for the DDP Macho Man feud, which was the main event. And then there was the Outsiders and the Steiner Brothers, and they had that thing where they didn't have a title match like at Super Brawl, but then they didn't have one at another pay-per-view because there'd always be some screwy thing like the Steiner Brothers getting ran off the road. So here was finally supposed to be the big match, and then it still didn't happen, but you had Rick Steiner against Kevin Nash. You had a one-on-one match for the tag titles.
Right, it was Nash and Rick Steiner. It was a singles match before for the tag team titles, right?
Yeah, so it's kind of the two guys I didn't like as much. I liked Scott Steiner and Scott Hall better, but I mean, so I still got kind of screwed a little bit.
That's a good point. You know, that's something worth pointing out. Like in so many tag teams that later split up and became singles guys, there's always you could look at one guy had strengths in one area and the other guy would have strengths in another. But with the Steiner's brothers, was Rick Steiner better at anything than Scott Steiner? In all honesty, I mean, you know, you always look at there's the breakout guy, and with the Steiners, you could say Scott was the breakout Steiner brother. But was there anything that Rick could do better? I feel like there wasn't, and that's not really a knock against Rick. It's just Scott was better in every regard, really. I mean, he was a better talker. He was a better worker.
I don't know about better talker. Come on.
Well.
But I like that he had the Hurricane Rana.
Neither of them were very good talkers, but If you stack them up against each other, I mean, come on, you know, this is applying some revisionist history, but the Steiner math, all the stuff like that came from Scott. I mean, just the ridiculous stuff. You can't call it good on the mic, but it's entertaining if nothing else. I mean, Rick Steiner, you know, he had a mini feud with Chucky before Halloween Havoc 1998, and that was really embarrassing. You know, that's the kind of stuff you never saw Scott have to deal with. So, but anyway, another rabbit trail on our part. But I really appreciate that you got into WCW, and your first pay-per-view was Page Savage 1, which was an excellent match, and what put DDP on the map, really. I find it kind of amusing that your dad just didn't give a shit or didn't know what WCW was. It was like, well, you're on your own for this one. Sorry. I don't know what this shit is.
Yeah.
So he would go halves with you on WWF. Is that what my understanding is?
Yeah.
But not WCW.
Yeah, or even like the Royal Rumble ones, because those usually fell like around my birthday. So I guess I always said, I want that for my birthday party. And I didn't have to pay for that one, and we'd usually get pizza and, like, cake. I'd kind of have more buddies over than usual. Usually it was just me and, like, my friend Chad that I mentioned earlier. I'd go to his house or he'd come to my house. And it was usually just the two of us. The birthday one, I kind of went all out more.
So were your parents into it at all? Like, did your dad, like, like WWF, or was it just that's what he had heard of and that's what he was familiar with and just, you know, kind of tolerated it? Or was it just, you know, he liked WWF and did not like WCW?
Well, I actually don't know if he really would be like a fan, but he would sit there and he'd watch it with my friends and I. And then, well, way back like in 94 when I first was really getting into it, I had a bedtime and it was usually like 8 o'clock because I had to get up earlier in the morning, earlier for school. And so what he would do on Mondays is he would record Raw to VHS for me. And then I could watch it like the next day. Usually what I wanted to do was Tuesday. I wanted to wake up earlier and like watch it before school. That way I could talk to my friend in school about it. And I wouldn't have to wait till Tuesday night, which put it back to Wednesday. I wanted to talk about it right away. So he was always, I guess, supportive of it as a hobby. But I don't know if he really liked it or not. Or I guess really liked it like I did, I guess. But my mom, she would sometimes like watch it too. And she really liked Scott Hall. I guess she said she had a crush on Scott Hall. And then she was really let down when he went to WCW and he didn't have the Razor Ramon accent. She was really let down by that.
Well, he did at first. He kind of did it at first. And then they told him he couldn't do it anymore. So he toned it down. But that's really funny, actually. But I can see it. I mean, Scott Hall, come on, the machismo, right?
Yeah, Chico.
Chico. My experience is somewhat similar in that, like I said, my dad was more of an old school NWA guy, not that he was really all that into it, but my mom was into the WWF. She liked Hulk Hogan and got really into Hulk Hogan in like the early 90s. And I can just remember I was never a Hogan guy because I feel like I never really actually saw Hulk Hogan. He only honestly wrestled on pay-per-views and Saturday night's main event, which wasn't really ever on my radar. So it was sort of like I knew Hulk Hogan was a big deal and a main eventer, but I felt like I never really saw him. So I didn't care what he was doing. But, you know, my mom was a Hogan guy. And then when Hogan went to WCW, she kind of checked out. And I feel like my dad became more interested in WCW when all the former, you know, WWF guys came in and the product as a whole just started heating up. So, like I said, Starrcade 97 was my first proper WCW pay-per-view, even though I didn't purchase it. You know, my dad and I, we didn't pay for it. We were just sort of along for the ride. After that, it was Bash at the Beach, 1998. Ooh. I can tell you that coming out of that Starrcade, Chris Benoit, who was scheduled to have a match with Raven that didn't happen, among other matches at Starrcade that year. And for whatever reason, I just remember hating Raven at the time. I just hated the dude, like love to hate him, which made him a really effective heel when you think about it, just as a casual fan. I don't know what it was, but I just thought he was like this privileged asshole kind of whiny character. And I hated him so much. So anybody that was going against Raven, I was going to root for no matter who they were. And it just so happened to be at that pay-per-view, Chris Benoit. And although he ended up wrestling Saturn, I took an immediate liking to Chris Benoit, just his ring work, the intensity of it, the chops, you know, the German suplex. It was just everything that I wanted to see in a wrestling match. This guy like embodied, and that was again coming off a period of not watching wrestling and not really caring about or appreciating ring work or star ratings or any of that stuff. It was just what he did out there in the ring. It clicked for me and I responded to, and it was just heightened by the fact that he was feuding with Raven, a guy that I just intrinsically hated for whatever reason. So Chris Benoit became, and that was the first Chris Benoit match I'd ever seen, 1997 Starrcade. Were there any other WCW shows that you dipped into that you purchased or you saw at the time?
Yeah, I saw, the first one I mentioned was a Spring Stampede that I bought. I saw Fall Brawl 97 at my buddy's house, and I only bought one other one with my own money, which was around the time of your Bash at the Beach. It was a Slamboree 98, and the main event was the Wolfpack against the Giant and Sting. But then the twist was the Giant became a bad guy. So you kind of had three bad guys in the same match.
Yeah, that was a show that I really wanted to get. Leading into the show, you had DDP versus Raven in the Bowery death match in the cage.
Yeah, that was the cage where I think he was hanging from the top, or he did some
I think it was Kidman, wasn't it? Kidman was hanging from the...
Maybe that's what it was, because all the flock came in there.
He just killed all of them. And that was the blow-off to DDP Raven, which was a feud I was so into. That was a show I was definitely anticipating after Raven beat DDP at Spring Stampede for the U.S. title. And I was like, oh, man, you know, now this is where DDP is going to get his revenge. And that was the big blow-off to their feud. And that was the funny thing. Raven and Benoit is what kind of hooked me into WCW more so than just, you know, the main event scene of Hogan and Sting and, you know, the big picture stuff that they were doing. You know, I got into Benoit and was super into his feud with Raven. And when DDP injected himself into that, it was like, oh, you know, this is what I am down for now. So you had DDP and Benoit at Super Brawl in 1998. You had the triple threat with DDP, Benoit, and Raven at Uncensored. And then it was, you know, it kind of just transitioned into DDP versus Raven as the feud. So it was like all the stuff I was already kind of into on the fringes that just brought me more and more into the product, which I don't know if that was deliberate or just a coincidence or what. You know, like I said, I had Benoit who I was drawn to right away, Paige and Raven, who I hated, and whoever he went against, I was going to be rooting for. And as soon as it became DDP and Raven, I was like, you know, this is my shit right here. And I figured, you know, Slamboree was going to be the big blow off to DDP and Raven's feud. Looking forward to that. You had the main event of, like you said, Sting and the Giant, and, you know, the Giant going NWO Hollywood after the NWO split, which was intriguing as a new fan of WCW. Didn't they also have
There was also Macho Man, the Hitman, Brett at that show too, and I really liked Macho Man, and I really liked Brett, and Brett was like my WWF guy at the time, and then I really liked Savage, so it was a pretty cool match. I can't remember if it was good or not, but it was enough that I was excited for that show.
You know, I feel like people kind of shortchanged it at the time, but I think that's kind of a good match, actually. I know I watched it not too long ago and thought, you know, this is not as good as it would have been in, you know, 1993, 1994, or whatever, but still kind of not half bad. You know, Bret Hart was not well served by much of his WCW run, but for what he got and for what that match was, I think it was pretty good, actually. And I probably sound like a WCW apologist, which, whatever, fuck it. But that was an actual match that happened and wasn't marred by interference or, you know, time constraints or whatever. I think they had a pretty good match, if I recall. Wasn't there also a Goldberg Saturn or Goldberg versus the Flock in a, like a gauntlet match sort of thing.
Yeah, I think it was supposed to be a gauntlet, but then I think Saturn just said he was going to do it all by himself.
Just said fuck it and took him on.
And then there was the Chris Jericho like battle royal thing where it was the cruiserweights, and then Dean
was
in disguise and got his match.
Yes, so that was the battle royal for the cruiserweight championship, which Ciclope won, right?
Yeah.
So Ciclope wins the match. He's going to go on to face Chris Jericho. It's like, well, that's a little bit surprising. Of all the participants and all the cruiserweights here, it's Ciclope, but takes the mask off in the great swerve. It turns out to be Dean Malenko, who'd been off WCW programming for the better part of a month, and yet was more over than he had ever been throughout the course of his feud with Chris Jericho. You know, Jericho talking about how Malenko was the man of 1,000 holds, he's the man of 1,004 holds, and was making fun of Malenko and his family and his wrestling proficiency and this, that, and the other. Good times in 1998, WCW. That was a pay-per-view that, honestly, I wished I had gotten after the fact. So, again, you know, you seem to have pretty good taste here with starting out with Spring Stampede 97, which was a great show, Slamboree 98, which may have been the best WCW pay-per-view of 98, now that I kind of think about it. So, you knew how to pick them, my sir.
Oh, well, you know how you were saying that you're not really a Hogan guy? I guess I seem to pick the shows to watch that were not really Hogan shows.
Yeah, he was not to be found on Slamboree, was he? Let's move on to any live events that you attended for WCW. Did you go to any house shows or you know, live Nitros or
I was actually going to ask you the same thing on then the next like topic, but yeah, I attended two WCW shows. You said you went to like a WWF pay-per-view. I've never been to a pay-per-view before, but I did go to a WCW house show, and then my second one was a Thunder. It was live, so that was pretty cool.
When was that Thunder? Was it? Do you remember what matches or what the card looked like at the time?
Yeah, and I still have like a VHS tape of that I put on a DVD, because I remember it was like a week or so after the Slamboree show, and it was the very last day of eighth grade, and it was Thunder was that night. And it kicked off with the Booker T and the Benoit, like best of seven. I think it was like the third or fourth match in that.
Oh, wow. So you saw one of the best of seven matches.
It was a really good match. Like, I've recently like rewatched it, and it was pretty cool. But then the rest of the show, it had that Jericho and the Dean Malenko thing where Jericho, he was yelling at him, give me back the belt, give me back the belt. And he just gave
right,
it to him
yeah,
by hitting him
he
in the
was
face.
Disputing, yeah. He was disputing Malenko's win at Slamboree, right, since he wasn't the guy who was supposedly, he wasn't, you know, officially part of the Battle Royal, right? So he was disputing that.
Yeah, so he did technically give it to him by popping him in the face with it.
So you saw a pretty good show, actually. That's when Thunder was a pretty decent, you know, it was the secondary WCW program, but it was still, they were still doing it live.
It still pushed the storylines because you still had the fallout from the Slamboree, because you didn't know there was the controversy over, you know, they're partners, but they don't like each other. And so the Giant, he came out and cut a promo. He said something like he was going to be the only champion and it was going to belong to the NWO. So he appointed, I think, Bryan Adams as his partner.
Of course. Well, you know, that was when Thunder was pretty much the to WCW what SmackDown was to the WWF when it first started.
Yeah, I think they beat
which
them
was
to SmackDown.
Still a pretty big deal show. I mean, it wasn't Nitro, but it wasn't that much of a step down. Like you said, it still pushed the storylines. It was a live show. So, yeah, you could potentially be in for a pretty good night if you went to a Thunder around that time. Unfortunately, my only WCW show that I attended was also a Thunder, but it was in early 1999. And they were doing this thing at the time where I guess they would do the live Thunder on, I feel like they may have switched to Wednesdays at that point. It might have still been on Thursdays. I don't remember exactly, but they would do the live broadcast, and then they would actually tape the following week's Thunder at the same time. Yeah. So
yeah, see, I think shortly after the Thunder that I saw, that was the end of eighth grade. I think they came back around in the fall of 98, and had already started doing that because somebody said they saw two Goldberg matches.
Yes.
Or something, because he was doing a bunch of squashes.
Yes. So they changed to that model, I guess, at some point, probably in 98. And what that meant was the next show, the second show that you were there in attendance for was taped, and it had to account for what was going to happen on the live Nitro on the following Monday. Now, WCW being what it was, what was planned and what was going to happen on a live Nitro was very much subject to change. They were kind of flying by the seat of their pants, especially around this time period. So you had things like, okay, you watch the live Thunder, and then guys would come out and cut promos and do interviews and talk about things that happened on the Nitro, which had not aired yet. When I came to this show, what they were promoting was a Nash versus Giant main event that was going to happen on Nitro. This was right after the Finger Poke of Doom, after the NWO had reformed as like the NWO Elite with Hogan, Hall, and Nash. They added Steiner, Luger, and Bagwell, I believe, and pretty good mix of guys.
Oh, definitely. Your favorite, Conan, K-Dog, probably.
They kicked him out.
Oh, really? They did?
This was after they kicked him right out after this happened, which I was very happy with, because I've always fucking hated Conan. So, but anyway, they're reorganizing the NWO at the time. So you've got this group of, main event top level guys, and they definitely got a pop, and it was, a palpable chill in the air when they came out. It felt like a big deal. But Nash would be cutting promos and talking about how he's going to beat the Giant and prove that he's the Giant Killer and the only Giant in WCW, this, that, and the other. And they're going to have this match on Nitro a few days later, right? You're like, okay, whatever. And a couple hours after that, same group of guys come out, and Nash is talking about how he proved he's the only Giant in WCW. He beat Paul White, sent him packing, and now he's gone. And you're like, okay, I guess that's going to happen, or did happen on Nitro, which sure enough, it did, actually, I guess.
Ooh, so it's like spoiling Nitro then. So that
was, yeah, yeah, it. But it was, yeah, it was very much spoiling things that you'd see on Nitro. And this is also when Chris Jericho is feuding with Perry Saturn, and they have the loser wears a dress match at, I think, Sold Out, or maybe it was Slamboree, one or the other. So there was a lot of stuff surrounding that feud. It was the Horsemen versus Henning and Wyndham. So I did see two matches with like Benoit and Mongo versus, again, Henning and Wyndham. They advertised a special dark match that would not be televised on Thunder of Ric Flair versus Barry Windham. This ended up consisting of, at the very end of the show, Ric Flair running out in a Bill Cosby sweater, hitting Barry Windham with brass knuckles, slapping the figure four on him, and getting the win. It was, you know, you can call it a match, but it was about 15 seconds.
That sounds worth the $20, $30 ticket right there.
Right. That was so WCW. I think Flair did actually cut a bit of a promo trying to put over the city and the venue, talking about a cage match that he had with Ricky Steamboat or somebody in 1988. Fuck if I know. But Ric Flair has a good memory for these things. And he spent more time talking than he did in the ring, of course. But yeah, that was our great exclusive dark match, a 15-second Ric Flair by way of Bill Cosby sweater slapping the figure four on Barry Windham.
I love so, it.
That was my WCW live experience, unfortunately. Pales in comparison to yours.
Well, the house show I saw in September 97, I don't really remember anything about it, but I've saved a little piece of paper because I bought a program, or it was a WCW magazine, and it had a piece of paper tucked in there, and it listed the matches, and there's some actually cool matches that were on there, and I'm like, holy shit, I saw these matches and I don't remember it. All's I remember is this moment, and it was weird. It was, the main event was Nash and the Giant, and Nash came out to, like, he didn't come out to the NWO music. He came out to a song by the Fugees, that Ready or Not, Here I Come. I don't know if I've ever used that before.
Really?
But all's I remember from the match is he was, like, stalling on the floor. Somebody chucked a big, like, popcorn bucket, hit him in the back of the head, and he got pissed off. Because, you know, WCW, they'd always throw, like, the trash in there.
Yeah.
It was a huge, like, full popcorn bucket, hit him, like, square in the back of the head. And that's all I remember. But the matches on the show, though, there was I think there was DDP, and there was Kurt Hennig. They had a match. Benoit, I think, wrestled Jeff Jarrett. And then there was Chris Jericho and I think Eddie Guerrero in a match, because they were kind of having the cruiserweight feud then. And I think there might have been Dean Malenko and, like, Ultimo Dragon. And I love Ultimo Dragon. That was one of the things that kind of stuck me with WCW. Or, I mean, not stuck me, but he really hooked me. He was, like, the cruiserweight champion, like, a couple years before that, when he had, like, the J crown and he had, like, 8 or 9 belts. And so I'm like, shit, I'm so disappointed with my childhood self because I didn't really pay attention much to that show, or I don't know.
I'm like that with some WWF house shows that I saw back in the day. I remember one, the main event was Jake versus Savage. And
oh, wow.
There was even a Shawn versus Marty. I think that was the opener on that show. And it was an incredible match. I remember even at the time as a little kid being stunned by this match. And again, it was one I went to with my dad, and he was like, that was the best wrestling match I've ever seen. But I remember literally nothing else from that show. I feel like I've looked up the card on historyof WWE.com with Graham Cawthon. There's another soft plug for you.
Yeah.
Which has, like, all the house show, all the TV taping results for WWF, WCW, and pretty much any North American promotion, just about. But it's just one of those things that, like I said, you take for granted when you're not super locked into the product at the time. So that would have been, that house show for you would have been, like, what, somewhere in 1997 thereabouts?
Yeah, I know it was September, because I remember it being, I remember this exactly. I remember they were building up to a WWF pay-per-view, I think might have been Ground Zero. And so the house show was on a Friday, and that was like the 2-week period where Raw was preempted, and they had like a Friday night main event Raw. So I think I was really wanting to watch that show. So I think maybe that's why I was a little like preoccupied.
Like I said, it's one of those things that if you're not a WCW guy, which, you know, admittedly you weren't at the time, then you probably aren't going to remember or appreciate the show for what it is, but you can look back on it and be like, wow, I definitely really saw something or missed something there. But
there's one other thing with WCW that I'm kicking myself for too. I'm still kind of kicking myself for is they came back for a show. I think it was a house show in mid 99, like July. And I didn't spend my money because, like I said, I was still spending my money on pay-per-views and everything. And I think at that point I was spending my own money because I had a job. So I was paying the full price. And I didn't pay for the WCW show. I was paying for the Fully Loaded pay-per-view. And then I think Jericho showed up a few weeks later on Raw. That's when they did the countdown thing and he debuted. And I'm like, man, I wonder if Jericho had been at that show or not. Because it was kind of borderline. And I remember, I don't know if it was around that time or not, but I remember like later on looking at his website and he actually had a list of every single match that he ever wrestled. I don't know if he still does or not, but he had a list on his website and it said Peoria, July like 15th or something. And it was Eddie and Jericho as heels against Kidman and Ray. And I'm like, oh, motherfucker, why did I not go to that?
On that note, we've got to go into a commercial break and pay some bills. Stay with us. Don't turn that dial, and we'll be right back.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Voice of Ring of Honor's Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you're subscribed to all of our great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. Just head to iTunes today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be podcast feed, the PWO PTBN feed, PTBN Pop, and of course the Kevin Kelly Show feed, which includes the full archives of my podcast. Some really great stuff. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. Thanks for being a fan of professional wrestling. More importantly, thanks for being a fan and supporter of the Place to Be Nation.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzuto here. In addition to the archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. And we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be podcast feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with clotheslines and headlines, main event, Mission Indie Possible, in our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on WWE, NXT, and Ring of Honor Super Shows. Relive Wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse and the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling podcast as we dive into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. All of this in addition to Scott Keith's Podcast of Doom, which includes discussions on questions from listeners as well as current day and old school wrestling. We also have sports covered too with the Sports Lounge, the TJ McClune Show, and NBA Team Podcast. On our brand new PTB Pop podcast feed, we offer great shows such as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both feeds on iTunes and be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows are available on PlaceToBeNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to check out the right-hand side of the site for details on how to support the site when you shop at Amazon and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is Parv, and I'm here to tell you to listen and subscribe to the Pro Wrestling Only Place to Be Nation podcast network. That's the PWO PTBN podcast network, where you'll find a ton of in-depth shows done by hardcore fans. We've got Chris Zellner's 1-2 Punch of Exile on Bad Street, and with David Bickenspan, a smash hit Between the Sheets. We've got Wrestling Culture with Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave, Goodwill Wrestling and the reaction shows with good old Will from Texas. We've got This Week in Wrestling with my man Pete and Johnny Sorrow, Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston's Pro Wrestling Super Show, Tag Teams Back Again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze, and a ton of other great shows too. And of course, there's Titans of Wrestling and Where the Big Boys Play with yours truly and some dude from down south called Chad. PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are back, coming to you live again, as previously recorded, and virtually from the Greensboro Coliseum with our second segment here on the pilot edition of Survey Says, a WCW retrospective. So we're going to move right into our next topic. I'm going to ask Andy, my co-pilot, was there anything at any point in the history of WCW that took you out of the product or alienated you and that made you say, that's it, I'm done, I'm not watching WCW anymore? Because the one thing that I have observed is that anyone who's been a fan of WCW for any length of time has felt disenfranchised after any number of years of watching the promotion. That seems to be the one constant in the history of WCW. So I'm wondering if there is a moment for you, and if so, what that was.
Well, I don't think it was almost as much as anything they did as it was like me, like personally, just kind of my feelings, because as you know, I said I was a WWF kid, and they were pretty much like full speed ahead, you know, with Austin as champion. And I still like WCW because obviously I went to the shows and I bought some of those like shows. But what really kind of for me was like all the guys that I actually really liked, they ended up in the WWF. So it was obviously that's kind of what made me, you know, stick with them, was because you had in 99, you had Jericho come over, and then even you had, like, I liked ECW, so you had some of the ECW guys sprouting up, like Taz. He showed up in 2000, and I think he was kind of eclipsed by the WCW guys coming over, the Radicals. You had Benoit and Eddie. I was really looking forward to when those guys jumped over. I was like, oh, my God, I don't want to see Rock versus Benoit. I want to see D'Lo Brown versus Benoit. I was, like, big into D'Lo Brown. So I was looking forward to, like, D'Lo Brown and, like, Eddie Guerrero. I thought that would have been awesome. And I ended up seeing that.
Battle of the Frog Splashes, right?
Yeah. I ended up seeing that later on, like, a heat match. It was, like, a throwaway main event, but I remember I taped it.
Yeah, that's a good point.
But I was still kind of paying attention. But the thing that I guess really kind of – really I stopped watching was I liked ECW. That might have became my number two, even though ECW, looking back, really sucked then the last year.
So you're talking about ECW on TNN.
I really liked Mike Awesome. Mm-hmm. I don't know if he was a good wrestler or not, but he came out and he just powerbombed people. It's kind of like Brock Lesnar now, where he just comes out and suplexes people. Well, you had Mike Awesome. He was just big dude, and he just grabbed like Spike Dudley and all these little guys and threw him through tables, and it was pretty cool. But then when he showed up in WCW, he was like – he was saddled with some really weird characters like the 70s guy or the fat chick thriller. And that's kind of when I'm like, I'm out. I like Mike Awesome, but I really have no attachments anymore because the Radicals are over there. Now you're fucking up Mike Awesome. And so I was like, that was when I checked out, honestly.
Yeah, I mean – you know, I kind of got into ECW, too, in 1999. Like you mentioned, ECW on TNN, where you got Mike Awesome chucking Spike Dudley into the fourth row from the ring. The gorilla press slam. Powerbombing Masato Tanaka off the ring apron through a bunch of tables. Then he comes into WCW, and you're like, okay, a lot of fanfare surrounding this guy, and starts off pretty strong, throws Chris Kanyon off the top of the triple cage.
Oh, that's right, he did do that.
Through the stage, actually, at Slamboree. We got to talk about Slamboree. That's got to be one of our pay-per-view series. And then he turns into that 70s guy, and then he turns into the fat chick gorilla, or vice versa. Yeah. I can't remember which came first. I don't get that. I don't know why they did that with him, because I know that ECW, Paul Heyman was big on accentuate the positives and hide the weaknesses of our performers, which he did to great effect for everybody in the ECW roster. Mike Awesome in particular, he was a guy who wasn't as big as you thought he was. And that was exposed, I think, when he went to WCW. But he was still big enough that he could be booked as kind of a hoss type guy, right? Where he's power bombing dudes, doing, you know, big power moves.
Yeah, because he was kind of agile too, because he could kind of like run the ropes and do like flying clotheslines and stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Kind of like The Undertaker, where he's a big power, huge guy, but really agile as well. So he's sort of a hybrid between the two, and really compatible with pretty much any type of guy you want to program him with. And you've got him doing these stupid gimmicks, which I guess you can chalk up to Vince Russo, but no, I feel you on that. As far as when you checked out on WCW, for me, I feel like it was around the same time. Well, I take that back, because what happened was I had purchased Halloween Havoc 1999, which was actually, it's considered the first Vince Russo booked WCW pay-per-view, but the show was pretty much put together before Vince Russo had arrived. I feel like Kevin Sullivan actually put that show together, because he was handling much of the WCW booking during that brief interim period between Bischoff and Russo, which wasn't half bad, to be honest with you.
Would he be responsible for that Road Wild 99? Because I remember kind of liking that.
Yes, yes. I believe so. Bischoff was out of the picture at that point, and I think that was Sullivan. If not Sullivan, it let me put it this way. It wasn't Bischoff, and it wasn't Russo. And that was still kind of a good show. I mean, it had some kind of dumb shit, like the main event of Hogan versus Nash in a retirement match, which was like, you know, kind of coming 5 years too late, whatever. But, I mean, it wasn't horrible. It's very watchable.
It was just like everything else WCW did. It had a really strong, like, undercard with, I remember a bunch of tag team matches, like the Filthy Animals were on there. And then you had the DDP and Benoit in the United States match?
Yeah, you had DDP and Benoit, which Benoit went over really strong. A tag opener, like you said, the Filthy Animals, and there was a brief stable called the Deadpool with Raven and Vampiro and the Insane Clown Posse, ICP. But yeah, like you said, a strong undercard. There was a Sting, Sid Vicious match, Goldberg killing Rick Steiner, I'm pretty sure. That was a show I did not purchase, but actually got to see while I was on vacation. This is another aside, which we're going to become famous for. On vacation with my parents at the beach. And for whatever reason, normally...
Was
you
it
know,
a bash at the beach?
It was Road Wild.
Oh, no, I was just saying you were at the beach. And I was like, so was it a bash?
Well, it turned out to be a bash at the beach, because we were there from like Sunday to Sunday. So it was the first day we'd actually gotten there and, you know, got unpacked, got settled. You know, we're just seeing what the television situation was, as you often do when you're out of town at the beach, whatever. And, you know, with pay-per-views, typically it's going to be scramble vision if you didn't order it, right?
Yeah.
So I put it on, I don't know why, but I put it on whatever pay-per-view channel that it would have been, expecting scramble vision, not thinking I'm actually going to watch anything, but just sort of for shits and giggles. And guess what? It's unscrambled. We've just got a random pay-per-view that's unscrambled that we didn't pay for whatever reason. You know, maybe whoever was there before us had done something to manipulate the box. I don't know. Got to watch free of charge WCW Road Wild 1999 with my mom, who, like I said, was really into Hulk Hogan from back in the day. And it was just fun, you know, when you're on vacation to not, you know, expecting to watch a wrestling pay-per-view to have it just pop up there. So, you know, that, again, is me being a little bit biased towards that show, probably because I got to see it for free and can't really – I mean, it's hard to criticize a pay-per-view that you're watching for free, right?
Yeah.
So, but I still feel like it's not a half bad show. And, you know, going into Fall Brawl, which I did not order and did not see at the time, still seemed okay. That had a very odd Sting heel turn, which didn't quite take because people still cheered him because they were tired of Hulk Hogan. But I did order, like I said, Halloween Havoc 1999. It's pretty strong card on paper. Did not deliver in practice. If you watch that show nowadays, it's a train wreck. I can remember hating it at the time because it was just such a disappointment. I went in with such high expectations, such high hopes, and it was a complete letdown. Like there was a Goldberg Sid match, their first match, and I'm just like, okay, this is gonna, if nothing else, this match is gonna, you know, blow the roof off the place. And it was kind of nothing. It was Goldberg punching Sid over and over and over again until the ref calls the match off due to blood loss.
Oh man.
By Sid. Again, a letdown at the time, but to watch it today, it's like Sid is bleeding like a stuck pig. I mean, he really hits a jigger. You know, you can't say it's not a violent match. It certainly is, but not the match I wanted going in. Like, I wanted a hoss match where they're, you know, hitting, you know, power slams and choke slams and jackhammers and power bombs and everything on each other, and it was not that at all.
Yeah, because I remember at that time, wasn't Sid, he was like the Millennium Man.
He was the Millennium Man. Yeah, that's what they were playing it up as. He was a big deal. I mean, there was a lot of hype going into that match, and it didn't deliver. Like I said, looking back on it now, I can sort of appreciate it for what it is, but it's still, you know, you're not missing anything. You know, Sting and Hogan had a screwy deal where, like, Hogan just lays down and Sting pins him. That was like a Russo special. He definitely came in and made his mark on this first pay-per-view in a very bad way. And it put a really sour taste in my mouth coming out of this show. And I'm like, shit, well, Vince Russo is obviously not the savior that people are making him out to be for WCW. This does not look good for them. And that kind of continued into the next two shows, which November was Mayhem.
Oh, man, sorry to interrupt. What really kind of pissed me off, I guess, with WCW, now I just had a flashback, was the whole thing where they were making fun of Jim Ross, and they did the Oklahoma.
Yeah.
I was like, what the fuck? Why pick on JR? And now everybody picks on JR, like Vince McMahon has him. I mean, then it just rubbed me the wrong way, because I'm like, I kind of like some of this stuff, but I don't know.
You're right. Yeah, that was really mean-spirited. Like, of all people, they decided they're going to fuck with Jim Ross. Like, why? I mean, he was never – I mean, of anybody in the WWF, you can't really single Jim Ross out as a WWF guy. I mean, he's sort of the one on-air person who's been pretty, like – I don't want to say anti Vince McMahon, but has been around the block and makes it known in his commentary, and they're going to, you know, treat him like a piece of shit with this parody character. He was called Oklahoma, you remember?
Yeah.
Portrayed by, I want to say, Ed Ferrara. I don't know. I'm not 100% sure on that. But yeah, it was just this really fucked up of all ways you can just punch down at a promotion. Like, Jim Ross is a target that I don't know why Vince Russo would want to go after, but that was totally a Vince Russo thing. And yeah, that permeated the product throughout late 1999 into early 2000. But just as you said, the nail in the coffin was the Radicals, you know, Benoit, Guerrero, Saturn, and Malenko jumping ship in January of 2000 when they went over to WWF. I was like, well, I basically am left with no reason to watch WCW. My two guys were Benoit and DDP. Benoit's now, he went from winning the WCW World Heavyweight Championship to the next night gone. DDP, I think he was feuding with Bagwell at the time, but didn't really have anything going on otherwise, and disappeared for the early part of 2000. So, I mean, the primary guys that I liked in WCW just weren't there anymore or weren't actively being featured. So, you know, like I said, I was still watching the WWF, and I got more into the WWF when the Radicals arrived and became – that's really when I converted to, okay, now I'm a WWF guy. Like, WCW is officially a cut-rate promotion. I'm still going to check in here and there, see what they're up to, but if I miss their shows, I don't really care because – WWF is where it's at, objectively and you know, from a personal standpoint, this is what I'm going to follow from this point on. I can't continue to support a promotion with no guys that I care about. My interest in WCW was peaked a little bit when they did the big reboot Nitro going into Spring Stampede, where they brought back Vince Russo and Eric Bischoff, which is a complete fucking shit show. If you've never seen that Nitro, you've got to watch it because it's breaking the fourth wall left and right. It's total insider references. It's crazy. It's bug fuck crazy. And I know that we have some friends who are pretty high on this particular show, and we've got to talk about it in greater detail, but it's insane. If nothing else, just like I said, that train wreck quality as an artifact, just to go back and witness. So I'm like, okay, well, WCW is interesting. It's still not the preferred promotion for me, but I'll check it out here and there. And like I said, Spring Stampede was I didn't order any pay-per-views after this, but you know, follow the results. Spring Stampede, Slamboree, like we talked about, the triple cage match. We didn't even get into the David Arquette WCW title win, which, oh my god.
Well, we can save that for Slam.
Yeah, let's save that one. Holy shit. But the funny thing was, towards the end of WCW's run, I'm talking by October, November of 2000, they kind of started to turn it around. Not to say that they were becoming a dominant professional wrestling organization again, but quite the opposite, actually. They became comfortable in being a number two, which sounds really bad, but you know, rather than doing the constant crash TV of chasing the ratings week to week, trying to beat the WWF, they said, we're never going to be able to do that. We might not ever get to that same level again, but if we can become a solid number two wrestling promotion, we're okay with that. Let's just focus on ourselves and not what our competition is doing. And when they just refocused and started doing things like the Natural Born Thrillers.
And then I think that's when they had the Cat as a commissioner too, right?
They had the Cat, Ernest Miller, as their commissioner, which he kind of traded back and forth with, I feel like, Lance Storm and Mike Sanders, who was sort of an underrated talent, at least on the mic, not so much in the ring. But again, they had this new talent they started pushing and mixing these guys with their veterans who could still go. You know, they brought Paige back. Nash couldn't work worth a shit, but they put him in a tag team with DDP, and that was sort of a good use for both guys. Booker T moved to the upper card, to the main event, became a multi-time world champion, which, you know, he was a 3-4-time WCW champion before the promotion was bought out by WWF. That's something that, you know, probably wouldn't have happened if not for Vince Russo, just to give him a little bit of credit.
Since you're more of an expert on this, on the later era of WCW, there was a thought I had. Maybe you can kind of clarify it for me. Thinking about Scott Steiner, and yeah, they kind of did really push him as a big main event guy that was like their champion then. Isn't that, I know he was Big Papa Pump like ever since 98 when he first went heel, but isn't that the quintessential Big Papa Pump? He finally came into his own in like 2000, because that's when,
yes,
it seemed like that's, yes, when he had Medasia. He was talking about the Freaks, and I can't remember him doing really all that before that point, because he was Big Papa Pump, but I can't remember him ever like having all the catchphrases or whatever before that.
No, you're absolutely right. They didn't strike when the iron was hot with Scott Steiner, it seemed like. He was always the breakout member of the Steiner brothers, and they didn't even split them up until early 1998. And Steiner was still a singles guy that they pushed, but didn't really get behind very strongly until middle of 2000, probably. And you're right. It was when they brought in Medasia and had him doing the promos with the Freaks, and he was beating up the commentators and the interviewers and all this shit, and just basically acting like a madman.
Yeah, because I guess I couldn't think of anything that he had really done noteworthy in like 99, or like maybe I'm kind of
no, I can't either. I really can't either. In 1999, I mean, he was there, he was around. It's not like he was injured or anything, but he was just kind of a, you know, a mid-card guy. I mean, he was a strong mid-card heel, but they never really pushed him beyond World Television Championship, World or U.S. Championship. Yeah. It wasn't until late 2000 that he got the WCW title, which he won off of Booker T, I think, in November, I want to say. I mean, it was late in 2000 when they really started pushing him. And he was absolutely the guy going into 2001. And like I said, that's when WCW decided, we're just going to focus on what we need to do as a promotion, what makes sense for us, not to try to compete with the WWF, because we're a long ways from being able to do that. After so many years of, you know, just squandering the opportunities that we've had, we've just got to refocus here. And they were doing a good job of that in late 2000 and early 2001. So it was very much the writing was on the wall. Steiner was the guy. He's going to plow through all these baby faces until somebody like most likely Goldberg comes back and, you know, beats him for the title. But, you know, they were definitely building him up and building up and rebuilding the promotion in a way that they really hadn't done in years past. They refocused, they tried to recenter, and ultimately, you know, it all came to an end. You know, they were purchased, it seemed like, at the 11th hour by Vince McMahon.
So since this is a WCW show now, is there anything that, like, stood out to you that maybe they actually accomplished better than the WWF, even though they didn't win the war? Is there anything that you can pinpoint that you liked a lot that they did better than the competition?
Well, I'm glad you asked. There's a couple of things. One thing that really comes to mind is that Eric Bischoff, he beat Vince McMahon to the, you know, evil owner, evil promoter gimmick by pretty much a year to the date, because Eric Bischoff went NWO, or was revealed as the NWO mole, if you will, in November of 1996, right before their World War III pay-per-view. It seemed like WCW had a third World War every year for a while there. But anyway, Eric Bischoff really beat Vince to the punch in that evil owner gimmick. And this is going to sound blasphemous, but I'm just going to go ahead and say it. I think that Eric Bischoff was better in that particular role than Vince McMahon. Now, hear me out. Vince McMahon is a much better on-screen character than Eric Bischoff. But as far as doing the boss gimmick, I think Bischoff was better, only because me personally, you know, I have worked for people like Eric Bischoff, so I can relate to having a boss like that who you just detest, who you hate, and you can't really do anything about. I have never worked for anybody like Vince McMahon. Nobody has ever worked for anyone like Vince McMahon. Vince McMahon is the guy who sits in, you know, the ivory tower that you never really see and you never really hear from. You don't interact with day to day. But Eric Bischoff, he's the guy you might actually have to work for and have to deal with. And he is a pain in the fucking ass. And in that respect, I think he was better at doing that particular type of character better than Vince, if that makes any sense.
So he's kind of like the middle management guy that you hate.
Yeah, he's the guy that you actually work for, that you actually see. And I know that it you know, Austin McMahon is the metaphor, right? Of you're a working class guy, you know, having to fight the man. That's the big picture metaphor. That's what people relate to. And I get that. But as far as the day-to-day interactions of what you truly deal with, you're looking at an Eric Bischoff way more so than you are a Vince McMahon. I mean, you're not,
you know, the guy that struts around and like,
right. You don't see that guy. You know, if that guy exists, he again is in the ivory tower making decisions from on high that affect you, but you don't really have to deal with him one-on-one. But Eric Bischoff, oh yeah. I mean, he's the dickhead to end all dickheads. And I don't know. I think I realize that and appreciate it more and more the older I get and the variety of jobs that I've worked over the years, just watching old Nitros and seeing Bischoff and the way that he comes off and just that smarminess and the, you know, the way he would kiss ass and just, God, he's just such a slime ball. I'm like, yeah, he was really good at what he did. You know, that's speaking to Bischoff as a character. I'm not talking about his management style or whatever. That's a different conversation. But as a character, yeah, Bischoff is kind of there. I feel like he, you know, as the boss, he was better than Vince. Vince was much better in other respects as an overall character. But just in that, this is where the buck stops kind of guy, that's Bischoff for me.
Well, I like your hot take.
That is a hot take. That's a hot take from Hotlanta. What have you got? What did WCW do better than WWF for you, if any?
Well, I had one thing written down because I was kind of putting this idea around in my head, and I kind of liked at first, I think my first answer that I would have would be how maybe it really wasn't a money-making thing that we know now, but it was cool visually, was all their locations like Hog Wild and then like even Bash at the Beach, like they had a Bash at the Beach on an actual beach, and then the Spring Break Nitros. It was just
the
cool.
Spring WWF. Breakout Nitros. That's a good one, yeah.
Yeah, then WWF was almost always in an arena. Like I think they had the Shotgun Saturday Night thing, but I didn't get to see it. But they were in bars, and that was kind of cool. But they were predominantly always in an arena. And WCW, they would always be doing something different, you know, kind of to mix it up. But actually, here's my real answer, is that
– No, not to interrupt you, but I think that's a great one. Some of the things production wise that stand out for me, you know, people talking about how WCW was the inferior promotion from a production standpoint, but you know, those Spring Breakout Nitros that was a unique presentation. I remember, you know, in 98 from the Club La Villa in somewhere in Florida, I think, and Sting, you know, rappelling down from the fucking helicopter, which is crazy.
Oh, shit.
And
yeah, he did.
Giant throwing Scott Hall into the pool. You know, somebody always ended up in the pool on those Spring Breakout Nitros. I mean, you know, that was definitely a unique presentation that you did not get ever with WWF at the time or even to this day. I mean, the stalest thing you can point out about the WWF product was their arenas and their overall just presentation. It was always, this is how Raw looks, this is how SmackDown looks, and it's only been in the last couple of weeks that they've decided to shake it up with their brand split, but who knows how long, you know, this is going to persist before we start thinking, okay, it's really same old, stale shit here again. That's a really good point, but yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
Here was my actual answer that I came up with the other night when I was actually watching the show and I was texting you about it. Well, and I made a note. I'm going to bring this up in an episode. it is mostly related to Bobby Eaton because that guy, he had like an ugly-ass mullet and stuff. But WWF seems always like really appearance-based. Somebody like Bobby Eaton could never get beyond job status. He'd always be like, if he was in WWF, he'd pretty much be like their Barry Horowitz guy who was always losing on the shows. Maybe he got like a token win. But Bobby Eaton would never go beyond curtain jerker in the WWF. And it's like, because I got, I guess, rehooked with WCW about 10 years ago. I started tape trading videos with our buddy Kurt. And I got all this WCW stuff from the early 90s that I had never seen before. And there was guys like Vader, you know, who I was familiar with WWF. And then there was Rick Rude. And then even Dustin Rhodes and Barry Windham. It was like those guys, even Barry Windham, he never really got anywhere in the WWF because I think maybe he was a little older then when he went there. but they stuck him in the tag team as like the Blackjacks and stuff, and he was like the Stalker, some guy that wore fatigues and had like face paint. But he
let's face it, he wasn't very good looking.
Yeah, so see, he never really went anywhere either, but on some of those WCW shows, he was like awesome, man. I loved his tag team with Dustin Rhodes.
That's a really good observation and something I've thought of as well with just the diversity of talent that WCW employed at the time, where it was guys that weren't the traditional cookie cutter. I mean, let's face it, you know, WWF wrestlers, it seems like they have to look like gay porn stars, basically, in order to amount to anything. It's a very set cookie cutter look. But in WCW, they didn't seem to care about that kind of thing as much. So, and that went from the talent to their referees to their managers. I mean, let's face it, WWF would never employ a guy like Ralphus, right? I mean, can you imagine Vince McMahon just seeing Ralphus and saying, this guy's on our payroll? I mean,
he's going to puke.
I'm going to puke. I mean, there's just no way they would ever employ somebody like that. I'm not saying, you know, Ralphus was this great revelation or anything, but I mean, he had a role in WCW and he played it pretty well, and they were willing to give him credit for what he was able to do, I guess, or what the way that he came off as that unique character, so to speak. Even their referees, I mean, we've talked about, I mean, I've joked with you about Scott Dickinson. I didn't think we'd get into this here, but Scott Dickinson, God bless him. I mean, the guy looks like he's totally out to lunch in every match. I mean, he looks like he does not know his ass from a hole in the ground. I mean, but I guess he was a fairly capable referee. I don't know what his credentials were prior to coming to WCW, but here again, another guy that just based on appearances alone, Vince McMahon, the WWF, would never employ. Just never.
Oh, wait. Wasn't Ralphus like a truck driver and then they just kind of gave him a spot or something? Does that ring a bell?
I think that was the story, at least. I don't know if it was true, but I feel like that's what they said. And Chris Jericho or somebody just found him, met him at a truck stop or something, and recruited him. And that's how a lot of guys got their jobs in WCW, it seemed like. They just, you know, met the right people, made the right connections, and here again, it didn't matter what the aesthetics were. If they were good at whatever it was that they did, they could get a job. Daphne Unger, you know, who was the manager for David Flair and Crowbar, which maybe they're another argument to notch in this category, but she's somebody that would never work for the WWF. Just doesn't have the right look, whatever it is, but had a pretty good niche in WCW. And that's something that, you know, WCW never went through their periodic spring cleanings like the WWF/WWE does, where they would lay a bunch of people off en masse. You know, they would keep people on the payroll and kind of forget that they still were getting a paycheck. I mean, the famous example for so many years was Lanny Poffo, the former genius who worked for WCW, I don't know how many years, and didn't work a match for several of those years, but was still employed by them. But the thing is, there are these guys, and I'm thinking, you know, the Alex Wrights, the Disco Infernos, the Brian Clark as Wrath or whatever, whoever he was.
Yeah, really, because Disco, he actually had some legitimate title shots, whereas mm-hmm. in WWF, he probably still would have always been like the jokey character. I mean, not that he was a really like a legitimate guy, like star in WCW, but they at least attempted to push him.
Right, and that's the point. Like, these guys, because they never got released, you know, for better or worse, had a little bit of time to develop their characters and to become more legit contenders, even though, you know, it may not have amounted to anything. Look at, Lenny Lane and Lodi. I mean, for God's sakes, they still are footnotes in the history of professional wrestling in the grand scheme of things, but they were guys that would have gotten cut within a year two of a, you know, WWF tenure. And they were around for years in WCW and, you know, it became this tag team, kind of got over, kind of did the Billy and Chuck thing about 3 years early, weren't quite as controversial as that ended up being, but was, you know, within that same vein. And, you know, they were guys that had some job security who still were able to draw a paycheck doing their thing and just developing their characters. And every now and then you'd see a guy actually break out. And it was just a matter of being at the right place in the right time. And nowadays, that's, you know, really something that doesn't happen anymore. If you don't take off right away when the company wants you to, you're basically dead in the water and rowing against the tide.
Yeah, or even like Damien Sandow, didn't they just kind of kick him out?
Oh, that's a prime example. That's an excellent example.
He had a really fun character. I really like that kind of where they kind of repackaged him as like Mizdow, and then they turned him and he became a good guy, but then it was kind of like, oh, well, now he's a good guy, so that's it.
Yeah, really talented guy who could actually be something, amount to something, and, you know, just got crowded out, I guess, and got released, and nobody really cared, and where is he now? Just turned up in TNA, which I hope that works out. But that's a prime example of a guy who, you know, had he been in WCW or if the WWE had been following the model of just keep guys under contract no matter what, he'd still be around and eventually probably find his groove, kind of the way that, you know, it's hard to believe that Zack Ryder is still employed here today and ended up winning the Intercontinental title at WrestleMania this year for, you know, just a quick spell, only to drop it to Miz. But that's a guy that, against all odds, still has a job with WWE. And it's the type of thing that WCW was really famous for. And every now and then, like I said, you'd have a real breakout talent. It's hard to believe that Disco Inferno started with them in, like, I want to say 1995 and was around until the bitter end.
Or even actually to go along that same line, like Chris Kanyon. I was watching Bash at the Beach 95. And he's, I think, one of the Lumberjacks in the Flair and the Macho Man match. So he must have been like a jobber in 95, but he was still there all the way through the end through gimmick changes like the Mortis character and then the Canyon character and all the different variations on that.
Yep, that's a better example, actually, than Disco, really, because Canyon really became something, especially towards the end where they started pushing him. He did this thing where he like usurped DDP's gimmick and he was, you know, doing the Canyon cutter on random people, which got him over very strong.
DD me,
yeah, doing the DD me thing courtesy of of one Mark Madden. But yeah, he's a great example of a guy who really broke out towards the end there in WCW. And of course, a lot of that talent got squandered in the WWF by way of the invasion. But that's not for us to harp on, because enough words have already been said and written about that, I feel like. But yeah, prime example. You're right. Absolutely. Yeah, just the diversity of talent employed in WCW and the longevity that they had is really saying something. What else have we got? Oh, two more things in particular, actually. Real quick. One of these you're familiar with. The other is not. There's not a lot to be said about this because it's just a straight up observation that, you know, it's an objective observation. And that's that Lex Luger, he can't straighten his legs when he gets knocked down. He's incapable of it, right? He gets knocked, whether he gets knocked flat on his back, his knees stay bent. If he gets knocked and takes like a front bump, you know, on his chest, on his stomach, he will immediately roll over onto his back with his legs bent, knees up. I don't know if his knee pads are too tight. I don't know if
his t-shirts are too tight.
Shirts are too tight. But no, the man, he cannot straighten his legs. He for the life, he's incapable of it. Watch any, maybe this goes back to, you know, his earlier NWA run, his WWF run. I'm not sure. I just know that any Lex Luger match that I've seen in WCW, he can't straighten his legs. It's impossible. I defy you to present an example, a match where he does. I'm not talking about where like he first gets knocked down and like he just is splayed out, like for any extended length of time where he's like pinned, his legs are never flat to the canvas. Would you disagree with that?
You pointed that out in a text, and I did try to find one. And you're right. He was laying there, and his legs are like off to the side.
You haven't found anything to disagree with, to dispute that, have you?
No, but I try not to watch too many Lex Luger matches anyways.
No, you got to watch more. You got to watch more Lex Luger matches. Yeah. All right, the other one. I haven't told you about this one yet, but it's another anatomical observation that I think you'll appreciate. Around similar lines, Bret Hart, his knees start where I think most people's shins are.
What?
Now, hear me out. I was watching a Bret Hart match the other day. I can't remember what it was, but the random thought popped into my head that Bret Hart's knees are very low to the ground. I think this is why he's able to apply the sharpshooter as well as he can, as well as he does. Like, because of this anatomical difference, it enables him to like have a lower center of gravity or something where he can pop that move on better than most people. Like, who does a sharpshooter better than Bret Hart? You know, Sting does basically the same move, and it still doesn't look as good as Bret Hart's sharpshooter, right?
Correct.
Maybe a guy like Benoit, but Benoit is, you know, he's kind of he's shorter than Bret Hart. He's, you know, lower to the ground, period. Bret Hart's a taller dude, but I swear to God, his knees start where you and I, where our shins normally are. His knees are just lower on his body. I don't get it. I don't get it at all. But watch some Bret Hart matches and you'll realize it.
For some reason now I'm thinking of, did you ever watch King of the Hill, like Cotton the Grandpa? Now I'm thinking of
yes!
that. You know, he didn't have shins at all, but
he didn't have any shins. This is Bret Hart for real. I mean, he has no trouble getting around or anything. It's not a physical impediment or anything. It's just it's the way he's put together. His shins happen to be much lower. His knees happen to be much lower on his body than most people, and that's why he's able to excellently execute his finishing maneuver, the sharpshooter.
Well, that's
I haven't shared that with you previously, but you need to look out for that from now on.
Yeah, and I love Bret Hart, so I'll have to take note of that. It's kind of like what my mom said about like Mark Mero when she saw him in the WWF as a wild man.
Tell the people what your mom said about Mark.
She said something that he has like no waist or something, like he's just a torso and then hips or something. Like there's no weight, and it is kind of weird. He does have a weird body.
It's true though, because I distinctly remember he would wrestle in like his boxing trunks, right, in WWF.
He was Marvelous Mark.
When he was Marvelous Mark Mero, exactly. So he would jack up his trunks before he went up to do the Shooting Star Press, which admittedly looked pretty impressive, but when he jacked up those trunks, it didn't look like he was any different, really. So that supports the theory that he really had no waist. He was just all torso and legs. Which was that true when he was in WCW as Johnny B. Badd? Did he have a waist at the time and it just disappeared into all torso at some point? Like
I don't know either. I never really paid much attention. It's just something that I always thought of that my mom said. So I threw it out there with your kind of.
Yeah, he didn't wrestle in boxing shorts in WCW. He just wore like traditional trunks, didn't he?
Yeah.
Right. So
yeah, it was the same style as when he was Wild Man. He had like the little undies and then
a little speedo thing. Yeah. So I don't know. Maybe he lost his waist at some point. Gosh. Wow. All right. Well, do we have any other quick hits, observations about wrestlers' anatomies or WCW?
Well, there is one topic we could hit on, but I don't have to. Like fat ass wrestlers.
Fat ass wrestlers? As in literally like asses that are huge wrestlers?
Yeah. We can save that for another show. That would be a whole show.
Well, this is a pretty deep dive, but you and I come from the old RSPWFA2 livejournal.com, where we had a tournament. What was it called? The Greatest Wrestler Ass Off?
I don't know if it was even a tournament. I think it was just a thread of comments.
And it was started I'm pretty sure it was a real tournament that we did.
I know I started it because it was mostly like, I said I think Sting has a bubble butt or like a big booty. And then somebody else chimed in with saying like Mick Foley and then like Ron Simmons.
Yes, it got a lot more play than you would expect for just kind of a random one-off thread. And basically the conceit was these are not
they're not like fat guys, they're like fit guys.
Right.
They
they're,
just have
they're
like
not
big
obese,
butt.
Like overweight guys. They just happen to be they're guys that have disproportionately large asses. And you pointed out that Sting was one of them, which yeah. True. I feel like Ron Simmons ended up taking the gold there.
Yeah.
But maybe points were deducted on account of racism, probably.
I forgot about that.
That's uncomfortable now.
Yeah.
But let's just call a spade a spade.
Black booties matter.
That's basically what it came down to. They were like, yeah, but, you know. So, yes, Mick Foley was in contention, Sting, Ron Simmons. There were a lot of guys that just had disproportionately big booties for their stature that we took note of. So I'm glad that that came up in our first episode, just to get that out of the way. Feel free to bring to our attention any more that we might be overlooking, because this should still be going strong here in 2016.
I think it was the Ass Off was what it was called, wasn't it? Or something like that?
I think it was called the Ass Off. I'm pretty sure. The Ass Off. Gosh, I really want to get into how much Buff Bagwell loved WCW and how much WCW loved Buff Bagwell, but I think we're running desperately short of time. I don't think we can do that on this telecast.
Here's one final thought that I have, because if this continues and we keep talking about WCW like this, I have now signed up for the network. I didn't want to, but I've recently signed up for the network because I own a lot of these shows, but I needed to fill the holes because I want to watch all the Starcades. And I just got to say that I hate you for it, Tim. Because now,
you hate me.
Now I'm giving WWF more money. And like I said, I'd rather pay half price because I only want to watch WCW. I don't care about the new shows. So I'm not. There's going to be so much stuff that I'm not even going to watch. So it's like I'd rather just pay like $5.99 for like the Bash at the Beach.
Well, I rather would too, but I'll just look at it this way. I'm happy to pay $9.99 even if I'm only going to watch WCW programming.
Or maybe they could deduct the dollar off mine because they don't even have Thunder yet. They could give me a coupon.
You know, you and I are the only two people in the world who are just waiting with bated breath for the WWE Network to drop like all of the Thunders before stuff like, I don't know, WCW Saturday Night, WCW
Pro
Bracket. Bracket Pro, yeah, WCW Worldwide, and, you know, the plethora of old school territory promotions that they definitely have the rights to and have their hands on and just haven't released yet. I would be, you know, nothing would make me happier than if all the Thunders just all of a sudden appeared on WWE Network, like, tomorrow. even ahead of Saturday Night, in all honesty. But I want both. I want Saturday Night and I want Thunder. Those are my two, like, holy grails.
I want the mothership. I want to go to the pay window.
The pay window, yeah. Hey, look, as long as we don't say or refer to ourselves as the mothership at any point, because the Vintage Vault has acquired the assets to the mothership as a property. So if we ever say that, we are guilty of podcast infringement, and there will never be another episode of the show. So we need to be mindful of that. And me pointing that out, it is not should not be taken as an example of podcast infringement. So I was very careful never to reference that particular in connection to what we're trying to do.
I'll just edit that out. Beep.
There you go. All right. So I think that about wraps it up. This was our inaugural edition of WCW Survey Says. If you would like to see future editions of Survey Says, please let us know. Topics that you would like to hear discussed, drop us a line. We as hosts hope to get better over time. That's sort of a given. We definitely have some ideas on tap. Our next episode, should we get there, could be considered The Gathering, if you will. So take that for what it's worth.
So are we on a collision course for The Gathering?
Maybe on a collision course for The Gathering. We'll have probably some controversial opinions if you hadn't gathered from this episode. But that's, you know, the type of thing you can come to expect here from Survey Says. So bear with us. If you enjoyed the show, I sure hope you did. Let us know if you didn't. But at this point, we're out of time. Please tune in to the new adventures of Robin Hood on TNT alongside Movies for Guys Who Like Movies. And check us out every week, every month on the Place to Be Nation podcast network. God willing. God forbid.
Goodbye!